In one voice, our nation must condemn racism, bigotry, and white supremacy. These sinister ideologies must be defeated. Hate has no place in America. Hatred warps the mind, ravages the heart, and devours the soul. We have asked the FBI to identify all further resources they need to investigate and disrupt hate crimes and domestic terrorism, whatever they need.
President Trump at the White House this morning condemning this weekend's pair of mass shootings in Texas and Ohio. The massacres in El Paso and Dayton took the lives of more than two dozen people in the span of just 13 hours, and once again started a nationwide conversation on gun violence and white supremacy, especially after the killer in El Paso, one of the safest cities in the country, appeared to post a racist and anti-immigrant manifesto online just hours before gunning down more than 20 at a Walmart near the U.S.-Mexico border. Alfredo Corchado joins us from El Paso. He's the U.S.-Mexico border correspondent for the Dallas Morning News, and he's been covering the shooting and its aftermath. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Barbara. Great to be with you.
So tell us, what's the mood in El Paso this morning, 48 hours after this tragedy, but just a day after Dayton?
Well, it's still a very heartbroken community, grieving. We just got the news this morning that the death toll has climbed to 22, more than 2,000 people injured. About half of the victims who were shot at were from Mexico, half were from El Paso. So this is grieving on both sides. I mean, for many Latinos throughout the country, this is the Ellis Island of the Southwest. And I think whether it's people in L.A. or people throughout the Southwest, I mean, this is where people connect to. This is where they came through. And so I think it's a grief that's shared beyond the border.
And what are you hearing from immigrants and Hispanic community? And given that the shooter allegedly targeted them at the Walmart, so many of the victims were Mexican or Mexican-Americans, what are people talking about?
People are afraid. People are shocked that this would happen in their community. This has always been one of the safest communities in the country. I mean, the U.S. side, obviously, the Mexican side, as we all know, has gone through a lot of drug violence over the years. But ironically, I've been standing right on the international bridge talking to shoppers from Mexico who are coming into El Paso, and many of them said, you know, I never thought I would be afraid of crossing into the United States to shop. And there's I think it's a commonality. You know, a lot of people from the United States have stopped going into Mexico to visit parents, to shop, to eat, and so forth. So I think now it's a shared pain between both sides. The fact that the killer came, drove from Dallas, from the Dallas area, you know, drove 10 hours, had a lot of time to think. As a lot of people, you know, tell me, you know, he was here to hunt us down. He was here to kill Mexicans. And in a city that's more than 80% Hispanic, I mean, that's just killing.
And we're hearing these reports of family members of victims of the shooting who were afraid to seek help, maybe are still afraid, and they're afraid they might face deportation or legal consequences because of their immigration status. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, we've heard that from several people who don't want to seek help. Over the weekend, ICE put out a statement saying they are not doing any roundups. They do operations based on investigations, and so they said there's nothing planned. But obviously today with social media, I mean that rumor has been out there, and so that has prevented people from seeking help. I mean, I think it's a city that's safe to say is a city that's in shock and it's traumatized from all sides. I mean, it's a city, it's an area that's been treated as a piñata for years, and I think El Paso and know that, you know, going back to, you know, decades, it's always a piñata for politicians every 4 years. But in the last couple of years, I mean, it's being hit from all sides, you know, almost on a daily basis. As one person told me yesterday, one thing is to feel like a piñata, but another thing is to, you know, face flying bullets. And that's what happened on Saturday at a Walmart that's very, very close to the Mexican border, to where, you know, it's easy for people from both sides to just meet there because it's right off the highway.
It's so tragic that at this time when people are feeling so vulnerable that they wouldn't seek out help because they're afraid and because of these rumors. So what help are they turning down? What help are organizations offering the immigrant community?
Well, organizations have been trying to, you know, say it's okay to come forward. It's interesting that this man I interviewed this morning, I'm interviewing him, and he's still shaking because he was inside the Walmart when this happened. And he's right on the border, and I said, you know, have you thought about seeking some help? He's legal. He has a green card, but he says, I just don't want to go through that because I don't know what they're going to ask me. I mean, there's just a deep-seated sense of fear of going to authorities. But he's still, I can tell, I mean, he's still very traumatized. He's in a state of shock. And yet he wanted to come back to El Paso to do some shopping, and as he put it, to try to you know, to take a step forward and try to face his fears.
Hmm. And how has the El Paso community responded? You know, they're victims.
It's been incredible.
They're people in the hospital in terms of blood donations, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, the blood donations, I mean, people, from the moment that the police department came out and said, you know, we need donors, I mean, the centers were just inundated with El Paso. So actually, people from both sides of the border came out and they were donating. I mean, there were circles. As of yesterday morning, there were still people lined up around the building. Other El Pasoans just got on their vehicles, bought water, they bought food, they went out to the hospitals to donate water. It's been incredible. On the Mexican side, you had a candlelight vigil by Juarenses right near the bridge, and they took out their cell phones and you know, put them up, and it was their candlelight vigil to show solidarity with El Pasoans. And as one Juarense said, you know, we're in this together. I mean, we now feel each other's pain.
Well, that's a real show of support. And I understand there's oppressive heat in El Paso yesterday, wasn't there? All this is happening despite the highs near 100 degrees.
It's summer. 100 degrees the last couple of days. We're all hoping for monsoon season. We did get some good rain on Saturday night with a lot of people here interpreted as tears from above.
Well, you spend a lot of time in Mexico, I know, and Mexico's foreign minister just arrived in El Paso, and Mexico's president has vowed to take legal action. What do you expect to come from the neighbor to the south?
Well, as someone who's covered the drug war in Mexico for many years, I mean, you know, the death toll over there over the years is more than 200,000 people have been killed. I mean, it's great that Mexico wants to take action. It's great that Mexico is saying, you know, we want to protect Mexicans and Mexican-Americans so that they feel that they're not alone. And I think a lot of Mexicans welcome that. But it's also, you know, it makes people question, you know, the impunity rate in Mexico is more than 95%. I mean, most of the cases, the vast majority of the cases have gone unsolved. Yes. You know, show all your support, show all the solidarity, show your care, but also take care of the victims across the border. So there is a sense of mixed emotions from both sides, at least from some of the Mexicans and Mexican-Americans I've been talking to in the last couple of days. But he is here. Marcelo Ebrard, the foreign minister, is about to have a press conference to talk about that, take legal action. I think he's also going to ask for the extradition of the suspect to face justice in Mexico.
And I want to ask you about the response from El Paso's political leaders, Mayor DeMargo, or former congressman and 2020 Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke. What are you hearing from them?
Well, Beto O'Rourke did cancel his campaign, has been in El Paso the last 48 hours and has been everywhere. I think for a lot of El Pasoans, it's been, I was at a couple of moving events over the last couple of days, and they've been greeting him. You know, you can tell he's visibly moved and shaken up by what's happened. I mean, this is his hometown, and he is fond of saying, you know, this is one of the safest communities in the United States. Obviously, having 22 people killed in one mass shooting surpasses the annual total in El Paso, which is about 18. So I think people are shocked. The mayor is also, when we talked to him, I said, you know, I've never thought I would deal with anything like this. And it's, I think it's also hard because he is a Republican mayor. And so a lot of the feelings in El Paso is really geared towards, the Republicans in office, and let's talk about gun control. Let's talk about some real action. So there is a sense in the community of, we want more than sympathies. We have to register. We have to go out and vote. We have to really make a difference, because this can happen again, and it will happen again if people don't get up and show that they are a political weight in this country.
Alfredo, thank you very much for the update.
Thank you very much, Barbara. Anytime.
And thanks for the reporting. Alfredo Corchado, U.S.-Mexico border correspondent for the Dallas Morning News. Coming up, what we know about the making of a mass shooter, the factors that can add up to a perfect storm of violence. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogavin from Madeline Brand. Mass shootings have plagued the United States for decades, seemingly coming out of nowhere and tearing communities apart. We call these shootings senseless acts of violence, but maybe there is a way to make sense of them, to find commonalities between the majority of mass shooters that may help us better understand why they happen and how to prevent them in the future. Joining us now is Jeffrey Swanson. He's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University School of Medicine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you have found five big factors with mass shooters. Briefly, could you state them for us?
Sure. We can sort of describe mass shooters in terms of common elements. I should say, though, that doesn't necessarily explain why they happen, because these factors might be shared by many other people who won't do this. It's a very difficult thing to do, to use this to explain and predict it. But just to try to, look at some common factors, and these come from the National Threat Assessment Service report from the U.S. Secret Service and the books that other scholars such as Catherine Newman at Johns Hopkins have written. The first one is kind of has to do with isolation and alienation. These are men, usually younger men, mid-30s, who feel disconnected from other people and from healthy relationships and sources of belonging to a broader community. And instead, they're resentful, and they harbor grievances. They're really angry, and sometimes that has to do with factors at work or school. Sometimes it's directed at a whole category of people, of others, maybe of an ethnic background or something. They feel victimized, and so then they turn to relate to other people who feel similarly mistreated and might share their distorted views, and then end up in some cases just sort of marinating in hate towards other people, and that gets amplified in a sort of echo chamber of social media, and it's sort of a closed circuit of people sometimes who share the same distorted view. So that's one part of the picture. Then on the emotional side, there's a kind of a hopelessness and indifference to life, and that's often manifested by the fact that people expect to die and sometimes do in suicide in these acts. Number three is that there is a kind of a deliberative planning process. People plan for and prepare for this attack, and sometimes they share information about it to other people, not necessarily the intended victims, but there's information that's available, but it's not put together in the right way. So it's what Catherine Newman calls a failure of natural surveillance systems, because people don't connect the dots necessarily. And that's kind of an element to it, but part of the recipe. recipe for why this happens, not necessarily the motivation, but for how it kind of can be allowed to happen. The fourth factor is what Newman has called a cultural script, right? Where does somebody get the idea that, you know, you could get guns and go out and massacre a bunch of strangers and you will become a notorious anti-hero? That is a uniquely American, very deviant idea. But, and you have young people sometimes with these characteristics who end up curating, you know, the collection of mass shooters and their stories. And then the fifth one is probably the most important in my view, and that is access to firearms. We're never going to live in a world where we don't have people inclined to harm others or themselves, you know, but I don't think we should tolerate a society where people like that, at a time like that, have such easy access to this really efficient, lethal technology that can, you know, it's designed to kill many people in a matter of seconds. And so all those things can come together, you know, and as you can see, it's not mental illness, which is what sometimes we like to say, you know, just the very, you know, simple thing.
Well, I was just going to say we're already hearing how simplified these factors and the simplification in the public discourse. You've brought up emotional disturbances of many kinds in those five factors, and also the issue of guns. And also then the social media's role kind of snaking throughout all of them. Yeah. So getting back to this idea of emotional disturbance, you often hear that one of the factors is childhood trauma with these shooters. Is that what you mean by emotional disturbance? For instance, the Dayton shooter was reportedly bullied in high school.
Exposure to trauma and violent victimization in childhood is a strong risk factor for not just mass shootings, but for violent behavior towards others in general. You know, it's very common if you look at people who we know are violent and you look back in their history, that's a factor. And in fact, it is one way of explaining violent behavior towards others that you might find in people with mental illness. Some of the studies we've done of people with mental illness, if you just look at people who have a serious mental illness, but they don't have one of three other factors, one being substance abuse, and another being exposure to violence sort of in the environment they live in. And the third, really important, is this history of violent victimization and trauma. They have a far lower risk of hurting other people than anybody else. But if you add, you know, just one of those factors, the risk goes up. If you add two together, like the history of victimization and they are now using substances as well, then it goes up again. And if you have all three of those things, it, you know, can sort of triple. So these are factors that compound each other. But yes, people, you know, it's really bad if people are growing up and they, you know, at a time when they should be establishing an intact personality, are being beaten and victimized and hurt by the people they should trust. You know, that's really, that's bad. I mean, many kids can overcome it and they're resilient, but too many cannot.
Well, researchers have framed this as a public health problem and that could have public health solutions. So what are the implications of reframing the epidemic of gun violence as a public health problem? And does it change outcomes? What does the research show?
Well, I would start by recognizing that, yes, it is a, you know, firearm-related injury and mortality claims the lives of over 100 people every single day. So on a day we have a mass casualty shooting, it is horrible. We're focusing on it. We should remember the 100 other people who died, you know, in domestic violence incidents or in suicide. That's about almost two-thirds. Or, you know, gang shootings or angry arguments that go bad. You know, and it is complicated. You can look at the motivation for it. You can look at the firearms part of it. And, you know, from a public health point of view, I think, you know, it's going to be a long time before, you know, neuroscience can figure out and deliver treatments that are going to prevent suicidal behavior or prevent, you know, aggression or anger. You know, there are treatments for these. But in the meantime, if we want to stop so many people from dying, I think what we should try to do is figure out how we have, you know, much diminished access to firearms in the hands of risky people. And there are ways of doing that. We focused a lot of attention on the point of sale and, you know, trying to make sure that people who are already legally prohibited from possessing a firearm can't get one through a background check. You know, that there are lots of problems with the background check system as we have it now. It's only as good as the data that we have, and the data are sometimes spotty. And we need better criteria that are going to correlate more directly with actual risk. We have lots of people who are prohibited from having guns and aren't going to do anything dangerous. Likewise, lots of angry, impulsive people who would pass a background check. So that's only one part of it, but it is an important part of it, that we should have comprehensive background checks every gun transaction. I think we should have gun licensing. But we also need a solution because our country, we have so many guns and so many people out there who are not going to be prohibited. We need a solution like the Extreme Risk Protection Order law that a number of states have enacted now, where if you know that someone around you is at risk of harming themselves or someone else, you can reach out to law enforcement, and they can, through an expedited due process, obtain a court order to remove that person's firearms for a while. It's temporary. It's not criminalizing. It's a public health intervention, and we've done studies in Connecticut and Indiana that show empirically that it can save lives. So those are two examples.
Jeffrey Swanson, he's professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University School of Medicine. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you for having me.
Well, in addition to blaming video games for the violence, President Trump today listed steps he believes will stop mass shootings. He suggested creating tools to identify early warning signs for shooters, reforming mental health laws, and preventing people with, quote, red flags to get guns. But what has the government been doing up to this point to stop attacks, and what effect, if any, has it had? Joining me to talk about this is Heather J. Williams, a senior policy researcher at the Rand Institute in Santa Monica. Welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you.
So, Heather, I was going to start by asking you what we know can work to prevent mass shootings, what has ever worked, but I suppose after this past weekend, the question is anything anywhere, including outside of the U.S., reliably working?
Yes, I mean, I think it's difficult to know what works and what doesn't because, thankfully, perhaps mass shootings don't happen that frequently. And so it's one of those problems where we just don't have a very large sample to really study it and to know when we've effectively prevented an event. I think the initiatives that the president, that those general areas or ideas of improving treatment for those with mental health, of trying to strengthen laws that could prevent somebody who has known existing risk factors from being able to acquire or maintain possession of their firearm, those are useful, productive ways for us to look at the problem. But there's going to be no single solution that stops these sorts of events from happening in the future.
Well, our system, our strategy as it exists now, though, does, if there even is one, seems to center on law enforcement solutions. And can you speak to the pros and cons of that?
Yes, we have had a very heavy law enforcement approach to the terrorism problem at large, both in terms of foreign and domestic terrorism. So if there is someone who is identified as a risk of becoming radicalized or looking at extremist material that we think could go on to conduct some sort of a terrorist attack, there's often a process of watching that individual to see if they actually do break the law and law enforcement can respond. There's sometimes even a probing by law enforcement when we're looking at foreign terrorism to kind of see if someone is responsive to being encouraged to conduct a more violent act. So that's kind of door number one, and there are not nearly as many resources put on doors number two or doors number three, which is to try to interact with that person in a positive way and see if you can steer them off that path towards extremism and radicalization and try to kind of normalize their behavior and prevent them from doing these kinds of attacks.
How do you know that works?
How do we know that it works to try to steer somebody towards away from radicalization? Well, I think we know that it is possible for it to work. What we don't know is which techniques work better than others. There's been a lot more work done abroad at trying to counter radical messages. It is a more pervasive problem abroad, at least the problem of Sunni extremism that we experienced to some extent in the United States, but was experienced to a much more profound extent in the Middle East and in Europe. There have been times where individuals who were part of a terrorist group have realized that that is not something that they want to be doing, and they have returned to their home countries and have put out kind of positive propaganda trying to deter other individuals from doing the same. And it seems like those things are effective, but what we don't know is exactly how effective and which programs we should be prioritizing in terms of giving resources.
Well, is part of the problem that there is so little research on these kinds of mass shootings? And many point the finger at this, that there was a ban on the CDC studying gun violence in the past, which has been lifted. But how much of an impact did this lack of funding for that kind of research have on the kind of research that you do?
Yeah, I think we have a poor understanding of this problem, both in terms of extremism, radicalization, which programs are effective, in terms of how severe the domestic terrorism problem is in the United States, and in terms of the connection to, you know, the relatively open availability of firearms in the United States. So where I think it's been most impactful is not necessarily laws like the one in relation to the CDC's research that prohibit research on gun-related issues, but just a general hesitance across the federal government to fund research into gun-related issues that help us understand those relationships and help us understand the severity of the problem. There has also been a lot more resources put towards international terrorism than there has on domestic terrorism. There's also less of an inclination to label things domestic terrorism, so it becomes very difficult for us to answer questions like, is the domestic terrorism problem getting worse in relation to the international terrorism problem? Or do we see more individuals drawn to domestic terrorism than foreign terrorism? If we don't know how many people are drawn to domestic terrorism, even if we have a sense of how many people might be drawn to foreign terrorist causes, we can't make that kind of a comparison.
Is there even reliable research on access to guns and to inform a public health response or a public health understanding of gun violence?
No, there's not, and that's a huge problem.
And what would that look like? I mean, what would it take to research that? What would it take to research how to cut down on the number of guns simply in the country?
Right. I mean, I think it would require an understanding of who has weapons, what weapons they are, where they are, how they're using them, how they're being sold. I mean, we don't have a good history of, you know, the life of a gun and where it might go. You know, there's also the kind of overlap between the patchwork of state laws and then the, you know, what might exist at the federal level that can further complicate our ability to understand the problem. So it can't just be a federal solution. There also needs to be greater movement amongst the states that would provide the kind of transparency that you would need to understand this problem.
And in terms of mental health services, that varies state to state. Is there any research that informs what kind of mental health services would help some of these, as our guest before you was talking about? Most of them are men, they're alienated, and they're angry. How do you reach them before things erupt into violence?
Yeah, so I'm not a mental health expert. There is strong research on what those risks are. Some research on what the risk factors are towards violence in general. It shouldn't be limited, I think, to just those who might have mental illness. There are people who are not mentally ill who conduct acts of violence, even acts of mass violence. So, you know, we do need to look beyond just mental illness if we're trying to understand the problems of mass violence and of violence against others. But those risk factors are definitely there. It's more prevalent amongst men, more prevalent amongst certain age groups, more prevalent amongst individuals who might lack some of those social connections. So individuals who are unmarried and unemployed are more likely to conduct an act of terrorism than those are not. There are still very few people who are likely to conduct an act of terrorism. So, you know, there are plenty of individuals who fit that profile who don't actually present a risk. So just knowing that there are some of those very broad generic risk factors doesn't necessarily give us all the tools that we need to combat the problem.
Well, thanks so much for this.
No problem. Thank you.
Heather J. Williams, she's a senior policy researcher at the Rand Institute in Santa Monica. Coming up, UC and Cal State schools are beset by a welter of lawsuits, and now they're facing one more, a class action suit brought by students accused of committing sexual assault.
This is an idea that, frankly, has been looming for a long time of how do we treat these allegations of sexual assault and sexual misconduct on college campuses.
We'll talk about that and other legal news with our own Jessica Levinson. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogabe. The UC and Cal State systems are both facing big lawsuits over their handling of sexual assault cases. These suits, though, weren't filed by survivors of assault. Instead, they're brought by two students who've been punished by their universities for sexual misconduct. And any court decision could apply not just to them, but to hundreds of other students, mostly men, who've been similarly punished. It's Monday, so Jessica Levinson is here. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular legal eagle, and it's wonderful to sit across from the table from you again.
Always good to be with you.
So there are two lawsuits, and one is brought by a man who was punished by the UC system already, and another is brought by a man punished by the Cal State system. What are these two men alleging? What are we talking about?
Essentially, they're alleging that when they were accused, they were denied due process. So this is an idea that, frankly, has been looming for a long time of how do we treat these allegations of sexual assault and sexual misconduct on college campuses? And obviously, what we have when colleges decide to give out a punishment, it's not the criminal justice system.
No, this is not a really a legal forum. That was my confusion here. I mean, what authority do these universities have to mete out punishment to these students who've they've determined are responsible for sexual assault?
Well, so it is and it isn't a legal form. It's like a quasi-legal form in the sense that there are serious punishments that are doled out. But if you receive federal funding, then you are subject to Title IX as a college or university. And so you have to comply with some of the requirements of Title IX when it comes to these instances, but you still have a lot of discretion in terms of the way you want to structure hearings, the type of punishment that you want to give out. And this is where we're seeing these lawsuits push back against the discretion that colleges and universities have.
And by saying you have to abide by the restrictions of Title IX, there are newer Title IX policies, right, that are aimed to be more sensitive to the victims in these situations. So in the case of these two suits, which cover anyone who was punished since June 2015, they're subject to these new regulations. So what's going on? What's the strategy with these suits?
Right. So President Obama changed the rules under Title IX. President Trump is trying to essentially change them back, make them more favorable to the people who are accused of sexual assault as opposed to the people who are the alleged victims. And so what's happening here is a strategy to try and push back against the colleges and universities who, for instance, do things like don't give a full hearing, who have a situation where they don't allow for a full cross-examination. Now, the new rules do change some of those things. They say it can't be the person who's done the investigation who then makes the determination. There has to be some limited cross-examination, not direct, but maybe you can submit questions. So the new rules do provide some additional due process, essentially. But it's this really difficult needle to thread because it's very hard to come forward with allegations of sexual misconduct when you are on a college campus. It's also very serious when you're subject to those allegations. We want to protect that person in some capacity and not just say, well, an allegation has been made against you. Somebody looked into it. seemed pretty credible, you don't get to come back to this school.
Is the idea of a class action lawsuit credible in this case, though? Are these cases so similar that,
so,
that they have standing?
That's exactly the question. We don't know if we can certify a class. So in order to certify a class, you would have to show that they've experienced essentially a similar injury, that there would be similar claims and causes of action. Essentially, that it makes sense to have a group come forward. Now, those who have been accused of sexual assault and misconduct absolutely want the class to go forward. It's much easier than this piecemeal person-by-person challenge to the current standards.
Okay, let's turn now to another story in the news. California Governor Gavin Newsom recently signed a new law that requires all presidential candidates to hand over 5 years of their income tax returns in order to appear on the state primary ballot. And of course, this was obviously aimed at President Donald Trump, who's famously refused to turn over his tax returns. But before we get to the, you know, what right do states have to do this, what's the benefit of forcing candidates to do this?
So the benefit is transparency. The benefit is more information for voters. The idea is that you could learn a lot more about candidates from seeing their tax returns than maybe than listening to their stump speeches. And what do we mean by learn more? We mean learn more about potential financial conflicts of interest. Who might they be beholden to? Is there, for instance, has there been some lying or misrepresentation about their financial background? And so the idea with disclosure in general is it gives the voters important information in order to evaluate their candidates. And I think that falls within that rubric.
It does legally, because the question is, do states have the right to impose those kinds of restrictions, on a primary ballot or any ballot?
I think that's an open question. This is a fascinating issue. We don't have a decision. And the question is, states have broad discretion when it comes to essentially acting as a gatekeeper function to the ballot and to determining how they're going to award electors in primary elections. And so we know states, for instance, have authority when it comes to implementing filing fees or signature requirements or even determining how a candidate in a presidential primary gets electors. However, bumping up against that authority is the Constitution. And the U.S. Constitution gives the requirements for what you need in order to be a federal, in this case, presidential candidate. You have to be born in the country, have lived here a certain number of years, be a certain age. And so if it looks like a new constitutional requirement, it's not legal. If it looks like a ballot access law, it is legal.
Well, is this one of the things I know it when I see it kind of arguments? I mean, how is this going to be resolved?
Well, it's going to be resolved by a judge looking to see, well, do we have similar cases out there? There is a case about 20 years ago dealing with a state that tried to implement term limits on its own and say, you don't get to be on our state ballot if you've already served X number of years in Congress. In that case, the Supreme Court said, no, that's a new requirement. That's not a ballot access requirement. But we don't have a case on all fours. And so we're going to have a judge who will look at this as a matter essentially of first impression, decide if it's permissible or not.
Jessica, always interesting. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
Jessica Levinson is law professor at Loyola Law School. Steve Chiotakis is here now to tell us what's coming up on his show, Greater LA. Hello,
in just
Steve.
A few minutes, absolutely. Barbara, we're going to have more reaction from Angelenos on what happened in El Paso and in Dayton, Ohio over the weekend. So tragic, and a lot of folks, especially in the immigrant community, they feel very vulnerable to what happened, given that the attack was likely motivated by hatred of immigrants. We'll talk about that coming up. We'll also bring things up a little bit and talk more about the U.S. women's national soccer team.
Oh, I saw everyone coming back from the game in Pasadena this weekend.
They played over at the Rose Bowl over the weekend on Saturday, so we're going to talk more about that and talk about pay equity, too. Then the women's team suing and trying to get as much money as the men make, and, well, we'll see where that is.
Good stuff.
All
right. Thank you for that.
You bet.
And coming up on this show, summer anywhere, but maybe especially here in L.A., calls out for a soundtrack. KCRW's Ann Litt has the perfect playlist for you. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogaven from Madeline Brand. It is time to soothe our souls with some music this Monday. We're only halfway through the summer, so there are plenty of beach days and pool parties left that might need a summer soundtrack. And we have the perfect person here to advise us, KCRW DJ Anne Litt. She's offered to share a couple of songs she's been jamming on so far this season and give us a little insider information on KCRW's concert series, Summer Nights. And it is so great to see you, Anne.
Thanks, Barbara, for having me.
So it does feel weird, though, to say that summer is half over. I don't know about you. Doesn't it feel like it just got started?
Yeah, and we're already deep in it, and people will be going back to school soon. I'm sort of in a reflective August mode, which is where these songs came from.
Oh, I think I know where you're going with this. And there have been a lot of new releases, certainly
yes.
This summer. What are some of your favorites?
Well, I think we're going to start off with Rafael Sadiq. He has a new album, his first in 8 years. And when I say reflective, the title of the album is Jimmy Lee. It's coming out August 23rd. And Jimmy Lee is the name of his brother who's battled addiction. And it has given Rafael Sadiq a moment to kind of sit back and reflect on it. His first album in 8 years. He's been busy in the meantime working with artists like Solange and...
Oh, yeah. He's a huge collaborator.
Oh, completely.
Right? With Mary J. Blige.
Yes.
And Legend. Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I was really excited to hear new music from Rafael Sadiq. So I brought one in for you today.
Fantastic.
I'm still acting living wrong. The drugs were too strong. And then I broke your heart, my friend. I went too far. I'm still
I love the energy and the vibe on this album. And I noticed that Sadiq is the composer in residence for Issa Rae's show, right? Insecure.
He is. And I love Issa Rae and I love Insecure. You know, I talked about Solange a minute ago. There was a song called Crane Like the Bird from her last album that we all kind of went crazy for here, remixes and whatnot. And he was the executive producer behind her album as well. He has a ton of collaborators on his new album. So I cannot wait to hear the full length when it's released.
And anything you want to say in particular about this song? What really struck you?
I think the thing I love about Rafael Sadiq is he can take subject matter that's pretty intense for him personally and bring it to life in a way that feels certainly light and breezy, but has a lot of substance and heft to it.
Yeah, it's that brilliant juxtaposition,
yes,
right?
Of which the, I love.
Right, of the mood and the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you also want to tell us about a song I know that's on the folkier side.
It
much
is.
Much folkier. It's called Watch Me Get Married from Bill Callahan.
Well, the first thing you'll be struck by with Bill Callahan is his voice. I just fell in love with him the second I heard his voice. And what's interesting about this record to me and why it stood out to me next to Rafael Sadiq, two completely different artists, but this is his first album in 6 years. And these are both very steadfastly kind of American artists who don't make a record until they have something to say. And that's sort of how Bill Callahan moves. And I thought this song was really, really indicative of where he is right now. He tours all the time. And it's one I've been playing a lot on the radio.
Let's hear what's on his mind.
Let's spend a light year together. Oh, I know it's a distance. From here to the stars. Watching us get married to the immensity. The orchid in the canyon is the one for me.
He's such a poet.
Oh, that baritone. It always calms me down.
It really does. And I think that's kind of the space my head is in right now. Obviously, there's a lot going on in the news and in the world. And I was really reflecting this time on songs that made me feel something.
Mm. Always good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what you want. And speaking of love and marriage, Chance the Rapper has released an album, I think was it at the end of July?
Yes.
Called The Big Day.
And technically it's his debut, but he's released a bunch of mixtapes throughout. They're calling this his debut album. But he also is recently married. He's a father. And this album really explores his relationship with his wife, his child, with God. And this song in particular explores his relationship with death. And I was really taken with it.
Interesting. Here's a clip, and the song is called Sun Come Down.
Please don't let my death be about my death. Please don't make no movies about my death. Please make my death about my life. If you make a movie about my life, make it right. Please don't make no holograms, don't want to do it twice. You want to use my likeness, please approve it through my wife. And if you get the license, then you better use it right. Don't misconstrue my offerings to offer new advice. If I said it, I meant it. If I'm dead, to cement it. And cinder block cemeteries already ascended. I leave you my last name, I left on the last plane. Too much baggage, but you could carry on Bennett. I just want to make sure that my words touch you. Pinky swear and kiss it, promise no one will hush you. Jump and hit the blocks, I promise you'll see the mushrooms. Clouds in the dust soon, leaving more thoughts than there are bristles on a brush broom. I let the sun come down.
Yeah, this is a sound and a side of Chance the Rapper I don't know.
Well, I think he's, as I mentioned, been really affected by his change in life. He's 27 years old and a family and married to someone he's truly in love with. And he's really thinking about, in this clip, he's thinking about his death. He's thinking about life. And what I like is that it's a person taking control of his narrative. Also, the presentation of the song is really acoustic. It's basically an acoustic song. And I find that incredibly powerful, too, especially when he starts rapping over it and all of that.
I wonder how his fans are reacting. And I did notice online he's getting a lot of blowback because a lot of these songs are about his marriage and how loyal he is to his wife and how much he loves her. And it's become a meme.
Yeah, I know. And I'll tell you, the album, I haven't read a ton of awesome reviews about it, but this song in particular stands out to me. I've spent some time with the album, and maybe, look, I'm just a lightweight and I love hearing this side of him, but this song to me is one of the most powerful on the album. And I do think he has something to say. And so I'm going to defend Chance the Rapper on this one.
I do not think you're a lightweight. And what I think you hear in this song is you hear him thinking.
Yes.
Which you don't always. That's a rare thing in
song
music. Or anywhere, really.
And I think you actually make a great point. In all three of the songs we've listened to so far, you're hearing the artist thinking, and I find that incredible.
It's really exciting.
Yeah.
Well, we've got time for one more. What would you like to end on?
Well, I'd like to play a song by an artist called Claro. She's, I believe, 20 years old, and she started making music in her bedroom, as many people do these days. She had a big, huge sort of Spotify, YouTube hit, and a lot of people sort of, you know, didn't take her that seriously. But now she's come out with a debut album full of music that I find super breezy here for the middle of the summer. And I love her voice. She reminds me, with all the reverb on it, of I Saw It Written Somewhere, a young Juliana Hatfield. And I just think this will be a great one to end on.
Oh, great. It's called Sophia. Let's listen.
I don't know who Sophia is, but the song makes me feel great. And I think it's a perfect one to end this hour on of Press Play.
Oh, it has that perfect vibe. I'm floating in waves. I'm driving down the freeway. just floating. I don't care who Sophia is either. But before you go, I can't let you go without asking you about KCRW's Summer Nights series. You just hosted this weekend.
I just did. We hosted Black Pumas here at KCRW World Headquarters, which was incredible. And we've got another show here Saturday night at KCRW headquarters with Ila Bamba. And we've been playing this album a lot from Ila Bamba. And Anthony Valadez and Valida will be DJing on either side of Ila Bamba. Also the same night, Dance Party in Chinatown with KCRW DJs Raul Campos and Mathieu Schreier. And Chinatown, historically, is the big dance night.
I have been to those, and they're wonderful. Yeah, that you can't miss. But that's really hard choice. That's really
a... It's a tough choice. And
six of one, half dozen of another.
I know. Yeah. Great DJs, great bands, and Summer Nights is one of our favorite times of the year at KCRW. We also had a great show last night at the Hollywood Bowl with Yola and Shaky Graves and Lord Huron, and there are more coming at the Bowl.
Well, I cannot wait to go to a summer series with you
I'd love
at
that.
Some point and to talk to you again. Thanks
Thank
so
you.
Much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Ann Litt, KCRW DJ. A good song.
Oh, I love Ila Bamba.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for Summer. So it's our own Michelle Eloy is here with feedback. What are people thinking about or talking about today, this
yeah.
Monday?
In light of, you know, all that happened this weekend, the two mass shootings, you know, we wanted to know how do you out there cope when you're just kind of bombarded with these images and all of this news of this senseless violence. Mercy Love Evolve says, number one, cry. Two, donate to Brady in every town. Three, pray and meditate. Four, be as kind as I can to everyone I cross paths with.
Oh, that is just a ringing call for compassion.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. I like that when she broke it down for us, too.
Yeah. Really nice. And there's a great, coming up in about an hour or a half hour, I guess, there's a great interview on The Daily with New York Times reporter Jennifer Medina, where, you know, she's a reporter and you can hear her audibly crying in the background as she is interviewing some of the folks in El Paso. And just, you know, kind of a nice reminder, especially for those of us in this job that, you know, we're not unfeeling beings, that this stuff is, it's tough.
Well, I hope everyone copes okay today. And I want to thank you for listening to KCRW. I'll see you tomorrow.